From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Megan Mack alongside Evan Dawson. Thanks as always for joining us for our wrap-up of the week on the talk show. We'll start this week's podcast with a conversation about religion and violence. Dr. Charles Kimball is an author and chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Oklahoma. His work focuses on the lethal consequences religion can have when it becomes too extreme. In this clip, you'll hear Evan read what Dr. Kimball says are five warning signs of religion becoming violent. Then you'll hear Dr. Kimball elaborate on those signs and how some are even present in local communities.
As I read it, the five warning signs of when religion could be moving in a violent direction with an individual is the following. Number one, whenever a religion emphasizes that it holds the absolute truth, the one path to God, or the only correct way of reading a sacred text to the exclusion of the truth claims of all other religions and cultures, that religion could be becoming evil.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Number two, blind obedience to religious leaders. Number three, apocalyptic belief that the end time will occur through a particular religion. Number four, the use of malevolent ends to achieve religious goals, such as the Crusades. And number five, the declaration of holy war.
Right.
So those are the warning signs.
Right.
And do we need to do a better job as a society of seeing those warning signs among us as they're happening?
Sure, I think so. And I think the point is, it's not, we focus on what's dramatic and sensational, the things that get the headlines, but a lot of these things are present in local churches or in local communities in one way or another. Too much authority invested in too few people. We see charismatic leaders emerge, Jim Jones or Asahara Shoko, the Buddhist guy who convinced people to release sarin gas in the Tokyo subway system. You can go down the list, David Koresh in Waco, Texas, and so forth. So we see that kind of example. Let me come back to the first one and tell you a sort of, I think, informative little anecdote. When the book first came out, in the first couple of years, I did over 40 hours of radio interviews, among TV interviews and other things too. And when people would want to talk about the five warning signs, the typical thing that would happen would be, I would talk first about absolute truth claims. And we would almost never get to the other four. And when the phone lines opened up, the first four or five people to call in would be proving my point about absolute truth claims, because they were the ones who actually knew what the absolute truth was. The thing to remember is, we're all human beings. To quote the Apostle Paul out of my tradition, we see through a glass darkly, not yet face to face. None of us have all the answers. None of us have everything locked down tight. None of us see the world exactly as God sees the world and the universe. And so whatever kind of truth claims we're affirming, and I'm not saying it's all relative, I think those are very important, but we have to always have a measure of humility and a recognition that there's more to learn. If you think of it in a Christian context, if there's nothing else to learn, why would you go to Sunday school? Why would you have a Bible study? Why would you listen to a sermon? Presumably because there's new insight, new way of understanding. But at a practical level, we find all kinds of people, particularly people who have radio and TV ministries, I find, who seem to think that they have all the answers. And many people like to gravitate towards somebody who tells them, here's the answer. I'll make it easy for you. Here it is. That's a dangerous sign.
Humility. More humility is what the world needs.
Exactly.
In this and all contexts.
At least a measure of humility,
I think,
to be sure.
That's powerful stuff. Next up, a conversation about why young people don't vote. Voters between the ages of 18 and 34 are really not planning to participate in the upcoming congressional midterms. Only 28% of people age 18 to 34 in this country say that they will definitely vote in November. That would be more than 4 years ago, the last midterm, when only 23% of young voters came out. And that's a big contrast. Voters over the age of 65 vote at a 74% clip. So why? What is it that is keeping young people out of the process? We had a discussion on the talk show. You're going to hear Patrick Coyle and Tom Hebert. They've done organizing and work for Democrats, and in Tom's case, Republicans. But first, you're going to hear a phone call from a listener named Chris, a young person who says he didn't vote last time, probably not going to vote this year, and wanted to tell us why.
I don't vote, and there's a bunch of reasons why, but I think a lot of it is that the parties are not representative of what we want as young people. You have people who are in the parties telling us that we're lazy when we're overburdened every day. And it's not that we don't want to go out and do things. It's just that we can't go out and do things. We have a lot of things going on. We have a lot of things to worry about. And then we have groups where we get behind a candidate, and then we have the party rally against the candidate. So we get into somebody, and then even if he gets votes, we still have a party that does what they can to eliminate him from the discussion.
So right now, are you thinking in November it's not worth voting?
At this point, no. I mean, I didn't vote last year. I don't plan on voting this year. It's not that I don't care about the situation. It's just that if I go in and vote, I'll vote a third party. I'm not going to vote for one of those two candidates when they neither one honestly represents what we want, and they don't really care about doing things to help our generation.
Okay. Let me ask our guest in studio. Stay there, Chris. Let me ask our guest in studio to kind of add. I'm sure they've got some things they want to add there. I'll start with Patrick. Go ahead.
I completely get it. I really do get everything he's talking about. You know what I mean? Just as far as, I think that's more of a lefty thing than a righty thing. Just as far as feeling like the party leadership doesn't reflect your views and doesn't want to help your generation. But the way to change that isn't by throwing your hands up and saying nothing's ever going to change. You know, the way to change is try to work from the inside of the party and try to make it reflect, you know, who you are and what you believe and what you want to see.
Okay.
Yeah,
Tom?
I think people are sick of politicians promising one thing and delivering nothing. Well, millennials in particular, I think, have been burned by President Obama, who promised hope and change, hope and change, hope and change, but didn't deliver on a lot of the things that he promised to. And I don't know if it's because he wasn't as liberal in office as he campaigned on or whatever. But the issue is you have to get engaged. You have to get out there and vote. You have to vote to upend the status quo if you don't like it. Now, I get the impulse to vote for a third party. I understand that. But right now, it's a two-party system, and you have to work within one of the two parties if you want to affect any real change. Quite frankly, people are too afraid to vote for third parties to actually make any kind of a change. And the way our system is set up, first past the post, third parties really can't get any traction. We're not a parliamentary system. So I get your frustration, but I think you need to work within one of the two major parties if you want to enact any kind of real difference.
And Chris, let me ask you, if you agree with voters who say things like, and I'm not trying to create sort of a straw man. I hear this quite often. They'll say, look, Republicans, Democrats, roughly the same. Congressional elections, Republicans, Democrats, roughly the same. Even presidential elections. And I know a lot of voters vehemently disagree with that, but some just feel like there's not enough difference. I don't see enough choice. I don't like the choices. I'm not going to be there. Do you feel that way, Chris?
If you're going to look at the last presidential election, we had someone who's on the far right, and then we have someone who's on the right of center. Even our left-wing candidate is still more of a centrist and more of a neoliberal than a true liberal. So we don't really have a true representation of the left side on either party.
Yeah, Chris, I'm going to jump in and disagree with you there. I mean, like, people, you know, I'm by no means an enormous Hillary Clinton fan, but obviously I voted for her. I mean, you know, it wasn't her fault what the media chose to cover. You know what I mean? If you looked at her policy proposal, she had some really interesting, truly revolutionary policies that would have transformed the way we think about deep generational cyclical poverty. You know what I mean? Obviously, that it rarely got covered, but she really did have some policies that were not, and she does, she has the deserved reputation as a centrist, but she was not running on a centrist platform. You know, I mean, there were things, you know, there was the health insurance comment, but a lot of her proposals, specifically the ones targeted at deep poverty, they were truly left, capital L, left-wing proposals.
I just want everyone to appreciate how unusual it is for a liberal to complain about media bias, but anyway, yeah. I don't really agree with your assertion that Donald Trump is a far-right candidate. I don't think he's a traditional conservative in most ways. I mean, we can debate his policy proposals, but if you look at somebody like Ronald Reagan or Paul Ryan, people that have been thought of as generally pretty conservative guys, I don't think Trump fits that mold. I think he's 100% different from anything the Republican Party's ever seen.
Okay, but regardless, I think it sounds to me like Chris is not seeing enough to feel like you're going to be there in November. What would you say the odds are that you vote, Chris?
It's going to come out to who the candidates are. It really does come out to what the candidates are. It's not a party thing. And I think a lot of people, my peers especially, aren't going out to vote for a particular party anymore. We're going to go out and vote for a candidate that we feel represents us. And again, I don't feel that we've been represented in the past. I mean, Hillary, I do feel she got a lot of undeserved critique for some of her policies, but she ran her entire career as a centrist, and then she wants to run a liberal campaign. It doesn't seem honest. It doesn't seem genuine. So, like, it just doesn't apply for Trump.
Do you wish, Chris? Do you wish, Chris, that she had won?
I'm indifferent at this point.
I presume you look at the Supreme Court and you care who sits on it, right?
I can sort of empathize with what he's saying. I really can.
No, I'm not trying to troll. Chris is clearly someone who wants a more progressive Democratic Party. And he saw, to Tom's point, maybe he was disillusioned even with a Barack Obama who governed more in a centrist fashion than to the left of where someone like Chris would want. And I get that. But I also want to ask if elections have the kinds of consequences that you would at least say, look, the Supreme Court matters. There's a lot that's on the line here. Someone like Tom might not love everything about President Trump, but cares very deeply about a Neil Gorsuch and maybe a Brett Kavanaugh. I don't know if that was the number one pick, but you're probably pretty happy with what you're seeing on the Supreme Court, even if you didn't love the candidate. And Chris, does that move you at all?
Well, it gets more frustrating because then we have a Congress who does everything they can to prevent what we've already established in our Constitution of how to choose a Supreme Court leader. And to have an entire party standing against one other person, it's frustrating to try to trust either group.
Okay.
When you see them both just fighting with each other without the interest of the voter.
Now to a conversation about abortion. We're continuing our discussions about a possible post-Roe v. Wade world if the decision is overturned by the Supreme Court. A little more than 2 weeks ago, we heard from anti-abortion activists about what they think that world would look like. And this week on the show, we talked to pro-choice activists. In this clip, the guests discuss what would happen if the abortion issue is turned back to the states, and specifically, what would happen in New York State. You'll hear Dr. Lauren Deutsch, executive director of the Healthy Baby Network. And first, answering a question from Evan is Dr. Rachel Phelps, medical director for Planned Parenthood of Central and Western New York.
If it does go back to the states, New York keeps reproductive rights. Other states do not. Will we see other people coming to the state? What's going to happen?
Yes.
Do we have the services for that?
No. I mean, we would obviously make plans to create those services, and we're already thinking about those kinds of things, particularly because geographically we're right next to Ohio and Pennsylvania, both of which are going to probably would not, if it went back to the states, not have abortion be legal or have it be highly restricted. But I'd also like to say that people are coming from other states already right now, right? We have patients coming from Pennsylvania to get abortions now. I just saw a teenager a couple of weeks ago who came from Indiana. She drove by herself, spent the night in her car to get an abortion in New York. We saw a woman last week from Michigan, right? So people are already coming from other states because there's such limited access in other states. But absolutely, that's what we're going to see. And unfortunately, one of the things that's unique about New York, unlike some other supportive states that have actually passed constitutional laws saying that women have a right to safe, legal abortion, New York State has actually failed to do that. We've tried to do it. We failed to do it. New York State did say that abortion was no longer illegal. So they sort of legalized it in the penal law pre-Roe v. Wade, but there's not an actual constitutional protection.
So if I may, there's a 1970 statute that governs abortion in New York that would become the law again on the day Roe v. Wade is overturned. It allows abortion up to 24 weeks. It is still in the penal code after 24 weeks unless it is for the life of the mother. So I think it's very unlikely that some New York prosecutor trying to make a reputation would go after an abortion care provider or a patient under that law. But that is still the state of the law. And as Dr. Phelps correctly states, Governor Cuomo has tried and not been successful in passing the Reproductive Health Act. In the last few years, it's passed the Assembly and not the Senate. So that is still the state of the law in New York. And I'm going to point out, too, that in addition to abortion tourism, for lack of a better word, that benefits women who are able to make the journey, both financially and socially, there's also going to be some impact to providers, to people going into reproductive health care for women. If it's legal in one state and not in another, what kind of training they get, to health care plans that are in more states than one, and what care that hospitals are required to provide to women with ectopic pregnancies, and the level of care that they can be offered at clinics that are federally funded, at clinics that are private, from state to state, it will really be a patchwork. So it reminds me a little bit of marriage equality before marriage equality was the law of the land, that if you were driving through the country, your marriage could go from existent to non-existent. Your rights, if you got in a car accident and you needed to visit your spouse who was injured in the hospital, could happen or disappear depending on where you were. And it would be like that for women seeking care, some of which care is incredibly emergent. So I think, you know, the idea that New York State would just keep us safe because we're such a blue state is not correct, and that it would really be terrifying new landscape.
Yeah. Two things. I also, think that it's important to understand, too, that best case scenario, if Roe was overturned, it would go back to the states. But that would open it up for Congress to be able to do a federal ban on abortion,
That's
which
correct.
Would then override
they
all
could.
Of the states. So it's not that you're just, oh, if you're in a safe state, you're okay.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM. We're always on the WXXI mobile app, so it should be on your phone. Very simple to use. Megan Mack, producer and co-host of this podcast. I'm Evan Dawson, wherever you are. Hope you're having a great day, and we'll hope you have a great week next week with us on Connections. Talk to you then.